Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. In this hour, leadership succession at an Eastern Kentucky powerhouse and a friend's tribute to Lexington musician Robbie Cosenza. First, the ghost of 2020 is back, and it's dragging a lot of baggage. Biden versus Trump again. It seems that with the country in such political gridlock, democracy is pretty fragile right now. And very intentional disinformation is coming on strong, outright lies presented as fact. Megan Garber, writing in The Atlantic, said, "Facts are work. They require study. They require curiosity. They require patience. They require humility. Democracy requires the same." Joining us is former U.S. attorney, University of Michigan law professor, and NBC MSNBC legal analyst Barbara McQuaid. She has a new book, Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Barbara McQuaid, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks very much, Tom. Glad to be with you.
So some will say, you know, politicians lying to the public is nothing new. It's been going on. But what would you say is different about what we're experiencing today in the lead up to an election that seems so consequential?
Yeah, Tom, I think there are really two things that are going on today that makes the current political moment different from what we've seen in the past. One is technology, which has allowed false claims, propaganda, misleading statements to spread at the speed of lightning, at the push of a button, and reach millions of people instantaneously. So there was a time when if you wanted to engage in spin or propaganda, you had to reach large audiences, you had to drop leaflets, you had to get in front of the right people. And now it's just so easy to do it, and it can be easily done with deception, because on social media, there are false personas. We're not required to use our own identities. As the New Yorker cartoon once said, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. So there's technology, which I think is part of it. But I think the other part of it, Tom, is that we are living in a time that is incredibly polarized. And it isn't just politicians who are to blame, but all of us who have really moved away from the middle toward the extreme edges of both parties. I think to some extent, this has been the strategy of both political parties to appeal to their bases and get people riled up for elections in an effort to improve voter turnout and voter engagement. But as a result, I think that not only are some people deceived by disinformation, I think there are plenty of other people willing to go along with the con if it advances their political agenda. And so, you know, just by way of example, I was just reading that Congresswoman Elise Stefanik of New York, she uses the term hostages to describe the people who were charged with crimes for their conduct on January 6th. I don't think she believes for a minute that those people are, you know, hostages, political prisoners, falsely accused to advance someone's political agenda. I think she knows full well that they committed crimes and they've been charged with those crimes. But I think she's willing to say whatever she needs to say to curry the favor of Donald Trump and his supporters for her own political gain. And that is where I think we are going down such a dangerous path in terms of disinformation.
Well, you know, clearly millions of Americans are buying this. They're buying the claim that the 2020 election was stolen. And despite the findings of scores of courts, including courts presided over by Trump appointees, why is this disinformation so effective?
Well, I think that part of it is the tactics that are being used. Many of these tactics are not new, even though the delivery mechanism for them is. Many of these tactics are things that we saw Hitler and Mussolini do. They prey upon human weakness and our cognitive forces to use fear and other things to motivate us. So we are living in a moment of great change, a rapidly evolving society, and that creates a lot of uncertainty for people. And so those willing to prey on fear to try to portray the United States as a declining country, those willing to demonize others and suggest that the reason for your problems are not because of tax policies that favor the wealthy, but you can blame all of your problems on immigrants or minorities or the LGBTQ community, anyone who is different from you, we can blame as the source of all of our problems. You know, these are things that we saw Hitler do and Mussolini do, using tactics like repetition, simple repetition. The more often I say something, the more likely it is to be believed. So if I say, stop the steal again and again and again, you're going to hear it not just from me, but you're going to start hearing it from your friends and neighbors. And pretty soon you're going to be believe it to be true. One of the tactics that Adolf Hitler wrote about in Mein Kampf was that the bigger the lie, the more likely it is to be believed. That's why, you know, people sometimes refer to the election claim as the big lie, very similar to what Hitler did with lying about Jewish people being the source of all evil. And what he wrote in Mein Kampf is that most of us, from time to time, might tell a white lie. We might tell somebody that, you know, they look nice today, or it's nice to see them, when maybe it's not really. But we do that out of a place of kindness or courtesy. And what Hitler wrote is that most people could not imagine anyone having the audacity to lie about something of great significance, and that we project that moral responsibility on other people, that most people would not do that. And so when somebody lies about something, it's actually more likely to be believed, because we just can't believe somebody would make up something like that. I mean, the idea of a stolen election, who could possibly fabricate that? Why, there'd be lawsuits, there'd be audits that would disprove those things. And yes, there have been. But then even when those things are shown to be true, people are very stubborn, which is another one of our cognitive biases. And once we form an opinion about something, it's very difficult for us to move off of that opinion. We are wired to win arguments, not to resolve problems. And so it makes us very stubborn. It makes it very difficult for us to move off an opinion once it is formed.
Well, in your book, you really drill down into something that gets us where we live, and that's that Americans are particularly vulnerable to this disinformation. Why are we such easy targets?
Well, I think it is because we so cherish the First Amendment right to free speech. Whether you are on the left or the right, free speech is something we all agree on is essential to our way of life, to our freedom, to our democracy. And so that is an immovable object, which it should be. It's essentially important. But what it allows for is cover for people who engage in disinformation, because they exploit that freedom. They say, I have a right to say anything I want to say, and you can't stop me. And who is the disinformation police anyway? Who's going to tell me that what I'm saying is wrong? Well, I think they're conflating opinion with fact. And so the fact that you have a right to say something doesn't mean that you have a right to say everything that is false. For example, we have laws that make it a crime to say certain things, like committing fraud is usually committed through speech, by saying, you know, Tom, I've got some swampland in Florida I'd like to sell you. Or conspiracy is usually formed through speech. The crime of threats is formed through speech. And so the idea that I can say anything I want to say and you can't stop me is not accurate, but I think it has some appeal because people are able to use the word censorship when anyone wants to curtail our free speech rights. And nobody likes censorship. Everyone knows censorship is bad. But I think that because of our strong belief in the importance of free speech, it makes it very difficult for us to rein in disinformation.
You know, it seems in the past, and of course there are exceptions to this, but it seems that in the past there's kind of been a norm of discretion that you can say that, but should you say that? Yelling fire in a crowded theater, for example. It feels as though that has just evaporated, eroded.
Yeah, I think that's right. And one of the things that's so interesting is that Donald Trump has come along and been such a disruptor on this front. And I think the media has still not quite figured out how to cover him. He will say, you know, very outrageous things. He will say false things. He will call people names. And I think that for members of the media who were trained to always give both sides of a story, to allow readers to have the straight facts and make their own determination and form their own opinion, really gets thrown out of kilter when you have someone like a Donald Trump or others who mimic his behavior, who is not acting in good faith. You know, he'll say things that are not even consistent. He said first that the FBI planted evidence at his house when they searched Mar-a-Lago for classified documents. And then he said, I had every right to take those documents. They're mine. Well, which is it? You know, he's not even consistent with his own statements. because, you know, truth is not his brand, so to speak. And, you know, there was a time when a political actor who said something that was false or hypocritical would be brought to task for it. And yet Donald Trump is able to get away with it. People find it, you know, refreshing that he says what he means and means what he says. He's so authentic. And I think he is, as a result, it's been very difficult for the press to know how to cover him. And he has been able to get away with a lot of false statements and lies. You know, say things like, during my presidency, the economy was at the greatest in the history of this country. And there's no one there to fact check him live and say, actually, no, that's not right. And to put up the data. And so when there is no one to rebut these outrageously false things, he is able to say them with impunity. But I think more than anything, he has pushed this idea that we should care less about truth than about tribe and identity. You know, there is a movement designed to undo the Christian national tradition of the United States and stick with me regardless of what I say, regardless of what I do, because I'm on your team. And there are only two sides. The other side is the devil. I'm going to demonize them. And I'm really the only tenable choice. Debaters refer to that as the either or fallacy. That is, there are only two choices in this world. And then I'm going to make the other one look so bad that you can't possibly choose it. I think that's something that Donald Trump and his supporters have engaged in to try to create an us versus them mentality. And for those who identify with his side, they don't care if he engages in lies. What they care more about is their tribe, their identity. And it doesn't matter to them whether he lies, as long as he is out there fighting for them.
In chapter 6 of your book, you state flat out that disinformation is destroying democracy. Not that it might or will, but that it is. Describe for us what this looks like.
Well, we're seeing it right now. After the 2020 election, which, as you just read, was the most secure in U.S. history, there are still people who believe that it was stolen. And so in response to that, we have seen state laws around the country enacted to make it more difficult to vote. And why have they done that? Because they want to stop fraud from happening, even though there's no evidence that there has been any fraud whatsoever. Even Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, said that there was no fraud in the 2020 election, that the Georgia election was fair and accurate. And yet he signed legislation to change the voting rights in Georgia to make it more difficult to vote. And these voter laws, you know, which include things like less time to vote in advance, curtailing the right to vote by mail, even forbidding people from providing food and water to voters who are waiting in long lines, which typically occurs in minority communities. These laws have a disparate impact on communities of color, on students, on people who are lower income and might have multiple jobs and don't have as much time to get to the polls on election day. And those are likely Democratic voters. And so it seems to me that this is a strategy designed to make it harder for certain groups to vote under the pretext of election fraud when election fraud doesn't exist.
Well, Barbara, you're a former U.S. attorney, you're a professor of law, you're a legal analyst, and a foundation of American society is respect for the rule of law, enacted by elected representatives of the public. How is this endangered now?
Well, when we have people who are undermining our courts and undermining our law enforcement by telling people that they're a disgrace, that judges are engaging in election interference, that the special prosecutor is working to do the bidding of Joe Biden to go after his political rival, all of that has an undermining impact on public trust in our institutions, in law enforcement and in the courts. Donald Trump has gone after judges multiple times when they've ruled against him. He's gone after the judge who was presiding over his Trump University case. He's gone after the judge in Manhattan case involving financial fraud. He's gone after the judge in the federal election interference case. And all of these things tend to undermine public confidence in the institutions that enforce the law. And the upshot of that is when people don't accept the legitimacy of our institutions, they feel not just licensed to take the law into their own hands, but they feel compelled to take the law into their own hands. And so we've seen a number of incidents in recent years in my own state of Michigan, a group of men who plotted to kidnap our governor, Gretchen Whitmer, because they were unhappy about her shutdown orders during COVID after they'd been told, that COVID was going to go away by Easter, and it wasn't a big deal, and it was curable, and all of this false information. They were unhappy, and they did not believe that the legal system was properly holding her accountable. So they were going to engage in a citizen's arrest and put her on trial. In California, we saw a man go into the home of Nancy Pelosi with a hammer and assault her husband. In Cincinnati, we saw a man try to breach the FBI office with an assault rifle after Donald Trump accused the FBI of planting evidence in his home in Mar-a-Lago. There was a man named Cesar Sayoc who sent pipe bombs through the mail to rivals of Donald Trump in the media and the Democratic Party, and had a van adorned with stickers supporting Donald Trump and denigrating his political rivals in the media. And so one of the terms that you hear for this is stochastic terrorism. That is, I don't know exactly who or when or why. The word comes from the word for random. But I know that if I say these things, someone is going to take the bait, someone who's unhinged out there, and is going to act on my insults of all these people. And so this is a violation of the rule of law, which says we have disputes and we have a mechanism for solving them. We are all held to the same standards, and we resolve our disputes in court through lawsuits and criminal prosecutions. We do not solve them through violence on the streets. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing as people in positions of public leadership use lies to undermine the credibility of our courts and our law enforcement agencies.
You know, sometimes it feels as though the genie's out of the bottle, that we're just careening toward this authoritarian future and not long from now. And in Chapter 9 of your book, you offer us a glimmer of hope. You suggest some solutions to this. Tell us what you propose.
Yeah, I won't go through all of them, but I would categorize them into largely two categories. One being things we can do together as a government, and then things we could do as an individual. So with regard to the government, I think there are some things we could do to certainly curtail some of the disinformation we're seeing. I mean, one is the way we finance our campaigns. Following the court decision in Citizens United a little more than 10 years ago, that decision held that corporations, organizations, and labor unions have First Amendment rights, and that spending money in political elections is a free speech right that is protected by the First Amendment, and therefore laws that limit the amount of money that these organizations can spend on elections were illegal in violation of the First Amendment. And so that has really opened the floodgates to dark money. And so we can't, you know, overturn that with legislation because it's an interpretation of the First Amendment. But what we can do is require disclosure of who is funding certain political ads, so that if it is a special interest group, we would know that instead of wondering who are the red, white, and blue grandmothers of America, which might be what they call themselves, we might learn that in fact they are some industry advocacy group. So that would be one way. I also think we need to think more carefully about how we regulate the internet. Social media is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful device for communicating with people all over the world. But under the Communications Decency Act of 1996, there is a provision that gives social media immunity from legal liability for anything that's published there. And I think it's time to rethink that. I don't know that we need to remove their liability, but I think we could focus on certain kinds of things to hold them accountable. For example, the algorithms that social media companies use are as much a part of the problem as the content that's there. The algorithms, of course, Tom, are these computer programs that tell which messages should come up to the top of our feeds and what we're going to see when we're online. And it's different for all of us. And those algorithms do a couple of things. One is, we know from a whistleblower at Facebook named Francis Haugen that Facebook, at least, was deliberately generating outrage through its algorithms. It would push to the top of our feeds things designed to outrage us, because the more outraged we are, the longer we stay online, the more eyeballs are on advertisements, and the more money the platforms can make from advertisers. And so if that's the case, perhaps we ought to forbid algorithms that manipulate us in this way, or at least require disclosure of algorithms that manipulate us in this way. The other thing that they do with these algorithms is they micro-target all of the users. So if I am a right-handed woman who's 59 years old, working as a law professor, serving as a lawyer in a family with four children who love sports, I'm going to get certain kinds of ads that other people are not going to see. And nobody sees everybody else's ads. as a result, that can make us very attractive targets for certain kinds of political advertising. We could require those social media platforms to disclose how we are being micro-targeted in that way, because that could help us avoid being manipulated by them. So those are just a few things on the governmental side. I also think on the individual side, there are a lot of things that we can do. We can educate ourselves to become more savvy consumers of media. We can teach media literacy to children in our schools. And we can also, I think, model the kind of civil discourse online that we would like to see in the world. I think too often people engage in snark. They see somebody say something outrageous online. It's often a deliberate provocation. And sometimes it might not even be a real person who posted this provocative statement. It might be some sort of AI generated bot. And a lot of us will start fighting with them and saying, you know, you're wrong and you're bad. And I think that we should try to restrain ourselves from that. You know, correcting disinformation, sure. But just saying things that are mean or snarky to generate likes and shares and signal our belonging in a particular political tribe, I think is part of the problem. And I think if people refrain from doing that, it might go a long way toward helping the kind of civil discourse we see online.
All right. That's former U.S. Attorney, University of Michigan Law Professor, and NBC, MSNBC legal analyst Barbara McQuaid, author of Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. And on behalf of our listeners here in Central Kentucky, Eastern Kentucky, we really appreciate you taking time for us, Barbara.
Thank you so much, Tom. I really appreciate it.
Coming up after the break.
We are proving that the people that live in Appalachia can do it themselves.
And remembering beloved Lexington musician and artist Robbie Cosenza.
It's true, I do not interact like I used to.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Friday, March 22nd, the Somerset Community College Laurel Campus in London will host Speakers Bureau, Appalachian Culture, Yesterday and Today, presented by Jerry Deaton. The show will begin at 10 a.m. On Monday, March 25th, Barberville Independent Schools in Barberville will host Primetime Family Reading. The program will begin at 5:30 p.m. And on Tuesday, March 26th, Alice Lloyd College in Pippa Passes will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Harlan, Colonel Sanders. Hard Work, Luck, and Perseverance. The performance will begin at 1 p.m. For more information on programs and coming events, visit kyhumanities.org. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
The Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky got its start 15 years ago in a small office in Chavies, Kentucky. It had an initial investment of $5,000 and was propelled by the hopes and support of community stakeholders. Since then, after receiving more than 30,000 donations, the foundation has pumped north of $35 million into the region, awarding more than 10,000 grants and creating a network of 11 community affiliate foundations. Jerry Roll was founding CEO. She retired at the first of the year and is succeeded by Kristen Walker Collins, who for 9 years served as the foundation's chief operating officer. We thought it would be interesting to get an update on the work of the foundation, which has included serving as a production sponsor of Eastern Standard. And I should note that the foundation continues to support WEKU. Joining us here in the studio, Jerry Roll. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
And Kristen Collins is with us. Hi, Kristen.
Hello. Thank you.
And Jerry, let's begin with you, if we could. I know that you are originally from Florida, and I'm wondering what led you to Eastern Kentucky and to doing this work in Eastern Kentucky.
You know, I used to tell Mayor Gorman, after you've been here for about 30 years, you ought to be able to say you're from here.
That's right.
You shouldn't have to remember that you used to live somewhere else, because I don't see myself ever being anywhere else. I love Eastern Kentucky. You know, and I came here to do what a lot of people come here for. I came here to start over. I came here as a young woman with two small children. I needed a fresh start. I needed a new job. I wanted to live in a rural area. And there was a job opportunity with a group of churches, and it called to me, and I came here. I think what's most important to note for me, though, is There's a lot of history in Appalachia about people coming here to save Appalachia. I often say, I came here so Appalachia could save me, and it has done that.
That's interesting. So what would you consider the foundation's most impactful accomplishments over these last 15 years?
I think our most impactful accomplishment is still happening, hasn't really happened yet, and that is that we have become a piece of permanent infrastructure in our region, bringing in philanthropic dollars. You mentioned in the introduction that we had made over $35 million in grants, and that's true. We're also at that same time and today holding on to $30 million that we are working with different groups across all the counties in our region to do projects and initiatives and invest and leverage other dollars, small businesses, nonprofits, family farms. We're working in so many different areas to lift up our region and rebuild our future for the 21st century and beyond. So I think our biggest impact is in creating that permanent infrastructure that will be here not just today, but for my grandchildren and my grandchildren's children.
Kristen, you've been there right alongside Jerry for 9 of those years. What would you add to the list of accomplishments?
To piggyback off of what Jerry said, I think the fact that we still exist and are doing this work, this backbone support work in a region that has historically been impoverished and people coming in to save Appalachia, and we are proving that the people that live in Appalachia can do it themselves.
Okay, those are accomplishments. Jerry, what would you say have been your most important challenges, even frustrations?
Disaster assistance. Mm-hmm. You know, clearly, Tom, the disasters that the state of Kentucky has seen over the last decade have just been horrific. We actually were there and responded to the West Liberty tornadoes in 2012. That was our first experience in disaster assistance. But we've also responded to smaller community disasters like an apartment building that burns down, the shooting in Allen, where some of our first responders lost their lives. We've been there to respond to those disasters. But then, of course, the horrific flooding in 2021 and 2022 really pushed us to our limits. But we were able to bring in a tremendous amount of resources, get them right out the door. And I think that's part of having this permanent infrastructure in the region and of the region to respond to those things. Doesn't mean we don't need help from outside. We all need each other. But having this foundation means that we are an equal partner. We're not waiting for someone to come in and help us. We're here for partners to come in and support us in supporting our communities.
Well, Kristen, time has gone by since the flood of 2022. Are you still responding to needs?
Yes, we are. We actually had several meetings this last week around long-term recovery groups that are in the region. We help fiscally sponsor several of those and making sure that they are getting money out into the communities. We are still working with housing, the Housing Can't Wait project that we have been working on with Fahi and several of the Chotos in the region, and just ongoing issues with infrastructure and resiliency and planning for what happens next and planning for when this happens again and making sure that our communities are prepared, our people are prepared, and our organizations are prepared.
You mentioned housing. How is that going? I know coming out of the flood immediately after, there was this great need and kind of a mantra, let's get everybody up out of the floodplains and up on higher ground. Is there any success in that?
Absolutely. Kristen mentioned Housing Can't Wait. The Housing Can't Wait campaign started when the emergency session of the legislature after the July 2022 flooding didn't allocate any money for housing. We found that to be, it was beyond, we couldn't even respond to that. So we did respond. We stood up and said, we're going to put $1 million on the table. And we were able to do that because of our ability to draw in those donations. We're going to put $1 million on the table. Our partners at Fahi came to the table with more money. And we said, and we are going to start building houses. So since that time in August of 2022, early September, We have, and when I say we, I mean us and our partners, the Housing Development Alliance, Homes, Inc., Appalachia Service Project, Samaritan's Purse, all of these housing groups that were already here and working with the housing crisis we already had, we've put more than 300 people, more than 300 new homes, rebuilt homes, completely rebuilt homes or brand new homes, and have hundreds more in the queue. Those groups were ready to mobilize and do muck outs. And then immediately we were able to get people coordinated, get money on the ground, and help them do what needed to be done. And next month, we're going to be breaking ground on the first higher ground subdivision, Chestnut Ridge and Knott County.
Well, Kristen, you've done work in family law, philanthropy, and as vice president of the Hazard Perry County Chamber of Commerce. How do you see these experiences? How do they inform your vision for the work ahead?
Thank you for that. I do refer to myself as a recovering attorney and get a lot of chuckles from that, but it's true. That experience of serving people in times of personal crisis really prepared me for the work at the foundation, as Jerry mentioned, in times of crisis with disaster, and being able to respond to people and understand where they're coming from in times of hurt and need. And then my other roles that I play in the community with the chamber and work around early childhood, these are things that impact all of our communities. And so I'm able to use my experiences as a mother, as a, I used to work in a small business before I joined the foundation. I work in a nonprofit. And so I can take these experiences and relate to people in our region. You know, I'm of this region. I, you know, spent a good portion of my childhood in Eastern Kentucky. I sound like I'm from here, and I can relate to people. And I can also use my experiences of living elsewhere to understand where our region not necessarily lacks, but how we can think bigger as a region to achieve things for our children. And as Jerry mentioned, her grandchildren's children, and how we move forward as a region to progress and build things that we want to see and want to experience.
Well, I know you've talked about shifting decision making and control back to local communities, local leaders. First of all, why is that needed? And secondly, how do you make it happen?
So why is it needed? You know, Jerry mentioned that we can't do all of this alone, but we also can't sit around and wait for other people to come in and rescue us being the region. And that's not how people in Appalachia work. That's not how we work. We figure things out on our own. And we need to provide our communities with the tools and resources so that they can make the best decisions and think big, not just thinking medium and, well, this is good enough. But what if we really came together and visualized what we want our communities to look like, what we want to raise our children in, and give them the resources and the knowledge and the belief that they can make that happen? And this is not anything against our elected officials. We have wonderful elected officials in Eastern Kentucky. They understand the communities, but they also have things that they have to do as well, and they have constraints that they have to work in. So when we put power into the hands of community members, they can work alongside government to help leverage dollars and bring in investment that the government cannot provide. And so while working together, we can move things along a lot faster.
I'm really glad to have you both here to talk about this, and that is that for so many generations, Eastern Kentucky's economy and life were characterized by extraction industries, and we're past that pretty much now. So what happens? How are you taking that forward?
I'll certainly let Kristen respond, because one of the reasons we're both here is because I am retiring and passing that on to Kristen, who is much closer to the age I was when I started out in this work. And I think that's part of the answer is, as elders, as a retirement age folks, we need to step aside and let the young people decide what does our community need to look like. You know, Kristen just said, when we talk to the community, we don't say what's wrong with us. We say, what's your vision? What do you believe? And then let people be engaged in that and the decisions to be made about how do we get there. And that's really important. And I think it's important for me to step aside and allow the younger generation to lead that conversation, to lead that charge. And what we're doing is we're creating small businesses. We're looking at the local food system, broadband, in-migration. How do we get more people to come to this region who might, like me, decide that with their young children, they don't want to live in the city anymore. They want to come here. What are the things we can do to make our communities the best communities for people to live and work and raise families? We can't just churn on our own economy. We know that. But we can build economies that attract new people, that attract small business, other small manufacturers, light manufacturing. You know, where Toyota's not coming to Chavies. But we might get some smaller manufacturing company that makes something for Toyota. But to do that, we have to create communities that people come to and look and say, wow, I want to live there. And I think if you came to downtown Hazard now, downtown Harlan, if you visited some of the communities where there has been this work has been going on, this renaissance over the last decade, you'll see some of that. We're not responsible for all of that, but we certainly are a huge contributor to that. And then what happens when you let the community do what the community wants to see happen, people can imagine their lives differently. And once people can imagine something different, then different things will start to happen. And that's the way we have approached it.
Kristen, would you say there is a prevailing vision, or are there many?
The answer is yes, in the fact that each community in Eastern Kentucky and Appalachia is different. They have different people. They have different interests. They have different histories. So when we're working with communities through our affiliates and other projects we have going on, it's letting them create their community investment plan, what they want to see, what assets do they have, identifying what is unique about their place and letting them build on that. Now, under the foundation, we do have this overarching vision for the region that all of these plans fall into. We're moving in the same direction. We might take different routes to get there. But truly what our goal is to live in a place where we have clean water, good schools, places for people to do things that support entrepreneurs, that have opportunities for people, and that are welcoming for all. And how we get there might look completely different. You know, if you drive 20 miles or 2 hours, you know, down the road. But we're all working towards the same things because we all have the same goals in the end. And a lot of times it takes a while to figure out that we all do have the same goals. But really, once we figure that out, we can go further together.
I know of a relatively new program, I think the Sycamore Fund, that's being led by Amelia Kirby.
Yes.
And I understand that it relates to building safer communities in ways that don't involve locking people up. In other words, prisons.
Correct.
Tell us more about that.
So the Sycamore Fund, led by, as you said, the fabulous Amelia Kirby, is a project of looking at community-level solutions for people that have been incarcerated or that are getting out of the carceral system and how we prevent having to use that system. So what, as a community, can we put together to support people that are coming out of imprisonment, to keep them from going back in? Or how do we create programs that prevent them from even entering the carceral system? This is as simple as, you know, one of the projects that has happened in Floyd County. They funded a project to provide people coming out of jail with an identification card. They were being let out of jail but had no ID card. So what did they do? They saw this. They saw the problem and created a solution for it. We're working with our partners at Apple Red and Mountain Comprehensive Community Care to work on wraparound services for people that are incarcerated. What do they need when they come out? Get a job, housing. What if they have civil legal needs, child custody issues, divorces, bankruptcy? So how do we help people identify these needs and then connect them with the resources that exist? Is proving very successful in Floyd County, so much so that we've had another affiliate that is interested in picking up some of the work in Jackson County. And we're looking at, this also involves doing research around what are the barriers that exist in our communities and how we work around those.
Well, Jerry, I understand that your retirement does not mean that you are actually leaving the foundation. You're continuing to serve in some capacity. Tell us about that.
We batted around lots of titles, and right now my title is Founder in Residence. And all that means is I am not going away. I'm not abandoning the foundation. I'm not even, you know, walking away for the final time. I will stay on board, on staff, for at least another year, maybe a year and a few months. But my role is very peripheral. It is to support Kristen. And I say that meaning very seriously, to be supportive, not obtrusive, to be available for transitioning, transferring relationships. Much of this work is about relationships, Tom. I mean, you don't raise $65 million without knowing people, getting to know people, not knowing them in the beginning, but getting to know them and building that trust and accountability. I know that's still there, but I want to spend enough time with the staff now to make sure that all of those folks still trust us and know that we are as accountable as ever, and maybe even more so. Kristen brings a world of skills that I don't have. You know, when you're starting something and you're the founder, you kind of just do everything. You do stuff. You make it work. Well, when you get to this level we're at today, you've got to have processes and policies in place. There has to be day-to-day really scrutinizing everything that's going on. And that's happening, and that's happening because of this staff that we have. But I'm here just to be supportive, also doing some policy and advocacy work. There is a lot of policy and advocacy work to be done around philanthropy and using the philanthropic tools that we have to complement and leverage the public money and making that work in our region. There were a lot of people for the last 30 years telling us this wasn't possible in Eastern Kentucky. And when we started it, there were a lot of naysayers, especially from outside the region, saying it will never work. It is too hard. It costs too much money. You don't have the capacity or the skills. We had a group of people who were steadfast and said, sure, we can do it. And we did. So my job now is to just make sure that Kristen has everything that she needs, and our donors and the rest of the staff know that we are here for them.
All right. That's the recently retired, kind of, sort of, Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky founding CEO, Jerry Roll. Thank you so much, Jerry.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jerry's successor, Kristen Walker Collins. Thanks so much, Kristen.
Thank you, Tom.
Recently, we lost a Lexington treasure, Robbie Cosenza, drummer, guitarist, songwriter, died after a 2-year battle with cancer. He had just turned 50. Many who know the Lexington music scene are aware of Robbie's presence. He performed with Pontius Copilot, The Apparitions, Vandeveer, These United States, The Scourge of the Sea, Horse Feathers, The Charbox Ramblers, The Wags, and his own project, The Fanged Robot. And we're joined by one who knew Robbie very well, his longtime friend and collaborator, Grammy-nominated producer, mixer, and studio owner Dwayne Lundy. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dwayne.
Well, thank you for having me.
So first, if you would just talk to us about your friend, Robbie Cosenza.
Robbie was a very charismatic individual, incredibly talented, but it was really his ability to communicate and connect with other artists and people in general that made him special. So I think that lent a lot towards people feeling welcome at, you know, at shows, and a connection with him that maybe they didn't with other, you know, musicians who might be a little bit more sort of withdrawn or not as accessible or maybe not as comfortable. And Robbie made everybody feel comfortable. And he was an artist beyond the music too. So, you know, he always sort of brought a very sort of organic, well-rounded, and always funny, you know, perspective to everything.
Carlo Ward's recent Herald Leader article about Robbie mentioned something that happened when, as a drummer with Pontius Copilot, he and his bandmates were on the verge of a big breakout opportunity when something dreadful happened. Tell us about that.
Like everything in the music industry, you know, 9/11 hits. And I think that that was a perfect collision in an imperfect way for a lot of artists where, you know, they're on the verge of something. The industry is evolving and changing, the downloading, the you know, the what would be the bottoming out of the traditional model of the music industry. Then you have that huge moment happen, and they were up there. From what I know, they had put in their time and worked really hard, and then there became this giant pause. And right after that, Robbie takes a little break and then moves back to Lexington and hooks up with the Apparitions. And then he and I's creative alliance in the studio, you know, begins.
As Carla reported it, they were in New York on the 10th and had bookings. Everything was looking good. And then 9/11 happened and it just tanked the whole thing.
Yeah.
Well, talk to us about Robbie's work as a studio musician, most often in your studio.
His gift was narrative. Great lyricist in his own right. We used to laugh about this. I would say, you know, I loved his drumming. I loved the relationships that he formed with the people in the studio. But the thing that made Robbie and I's thing sort of happen as I was going into an industry that I had no clue about was Robbie was always available. So whenever I would place a call to Robbie, I could rely on him to be there, and he would do anything that it took to make a session sort of go. He found the naive fun in it that is easy to sort of lose as you do the passion of your life and it turns into a business. There's a part of that that gets left behind, and you forget those moments when you were a kid sitting with your guitar, your instrument, or your buddies and your four track, and you were doing this thing and you thought that you could sort of, you know, at least change your own world. And he never really lost that. So our relationship began very naively as two people that sort of needed one another. You know, I had big opinions about everything and expressed them in a very Shakespearean sort of way. And Robbie was, I would say, warmer. And we had a really good sort of good cop, bad cop thing going with that. He could play the worst first take of a song that really any drummer could ever play. I mean, it was just like it was inappropriate. It was too loud. It was too soft. It was all over the place. And a lot of times the artists who were coming from all over the world to work at the studio would look at me with a pretty big question mark in their eyes until he would come in and listen to the playback and recite every word back to the singer. And, you know, he sort of got their trust. And then he would go back to the drums and not only play drums from a drummer beat perspective, keeping time, but he was a great sound designer. So he knew lyrics and he knew where there might be an opportunity to flourish, you know, or outline a particular lyric. And as much as I love drummers, they're not known for that. You know, they're known to sort of stay in their own head. They got a big responsibility. They got the most things to hit. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he was able to do that, I think was a very unusual relationship between the artist that we were working with and a drummer.
Let's listen to something. I asked you to pick out something that you thought would be really representative, and you chose one of Robbie's tunes titled Let the Countdown Count Me. Tell us about it.
The lyrics are typically Robbie. I mean, they're very intelligent. I think you can sort of read into whatever your interpretation is with it. I always felt like that there was a personal thing with him, but at the same time, you could sort of interject yourself into whatever his narrative was. And he came in, we picked him up in the morning, and, you know, 4 hours later, we were done. It was a beautiful day.
All right, let's listen.
It's true, I do not interact like I used to. See, they changed me, now I do what they say. I've tried to find a kind of my kind. I feel so stripped. Where is my ship? Underground or undersea? Let the countdown count
Well, that's Robbie Cosenza performing vocals and all the instruments on Let the Countdown Count Me, recorded in your studio, Duane. A lot of people remember Robbie not only for his chops as a musician, but for he had a knack for being funny. And thinking back over the many, many experiences you share with Robbie, anything stand out in your memory as a real knee slapper?
Robbie was sort of a walking show in all the best of ways. My favorite thing about Robbie's, you know, sense of humor and personality was that the studio can get tense, especially those first 10 years that we worked together. I was a very serious, you know, I had two kids and a wife and, you know, really wanted to just do the best that we could all the time. I really felt like we were always sort of working against the tide, being from Lexington as opposed to being from a major market. And Robbie was always there, generally with a doodle, you know, of some sort on a piece of paper. He had his own particular sort of style. This sort of always reminded me, it was reminiscent of, say, John Lennon, the way he would do things. And Robbie never really let me take myself too serious. You know, there was always a pizza joke or some random way that poke fun at me that he knew I could sort of tolerate and, you know, lighten the mood. Everything with him was always an opportunity to perform. He was an entertainer, and that went both in a professional and personal aspect of his life.
What do you hope Robbie Cosenza will be remembered for?
Robbie had a lot of tribes. He had his own sort of universe. He would create these relationships in a very uncalculated, naive, fun way with people in all different facets. So I think that what most people remember him for is his personality and how he touched it on a personal level. It's important for me and, you know, a lot of his musical friends and I think his family to make sure that the work that he did is present and is well archived. There's quite a bit to release. We've got two albums of original material, you know, that should be coming out over the course of the next 6 months to a year. And he didn't give, you know, clear direction, but he knew that we knew he wanted the material to be heard. So I think as an artist in all sense of the word and a person that could, you know, inspire a particular mood when he walked into the room is what he'll be remembered for.
Lexington music producer and studio owner Duane Lundy. Duane, I know this is a sad time for you, and I really appreciate your willingness to join us to remember your friend, Robbie Cosenza.
Thank you very much.
Robbie Cosenza had endured a long battle with a rare and aggressive form of cancer. He was 50 when he passed away in February. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up there for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.